80 years ago, Amelia Earhart and her navigator Fred Noonan disappeared over the Pacific Ocean without a trace. All over the world lie scattered pieces of her puzzle, waiting to be put together. Welcome to the Chasing Earhart podcast. I'm your host and the project creator, Chris Williamson. I promised Miss E I would never tell anyone her story, and I'm not really. But she never said anything about not writing it down. As far as I'm concerned, a girl's diary is pretty much the most private place someone could ever put something, so writing it here all but guarantees that no one will ever know what really happened to Miss E. Some diaries stay private because they're locked away in a nightstand, or hidden under a mattress. But most of the time they're private, because who really has the time to go and read all the boring stuff that goes on in someone else's life? And as far as boring lives go, mine had to be up there in the top 10, until we moved to California at least. So, there's not much chance of someone prying into my private life. Although I suppose someone could show an interest after I die. Seems like people always become more interesting after they're dead and gone, and others end up examining their letters and diaries and just about everything they wrote, trying to find something about the person that they probably could have found out while they were living, just going up and asking them. But they didn't. Miss E sure stirred up a lot of attention for herself when she died. Folks probably wouldn't have been half as interested in her if they knew she was alive and well, living on a farm north of San Francisco. And besides, what I'm writing here isn't really Miss E's story. It's mine. This podcast contains detailed plot spoilers from the novel Miss E by author Brian Herberger. If you have not yet read Miss E, or you intend to read it in the near future, please pause this podcast and come back after you've read it. Listener discretion is advised. Hello and welcome to the Chasing Earhart podcast. I am your host and the project creator, Chris Williamson. It's an absolute pleasure to be back with you for episode 6 of Chasing Earhart. Now, before we get to this week's guest, Brian Herberger, who is the author of Miss E, and I think you'll really like this podcast, I wanted to touch on a quick few things that we have going on in the project and give you some updates on what we have coming out in the coming weeks and months. Now, the first thing I want to touch on is our announcement teaser trailer. Now, a lot of folks have been asking us, when are we going to get to see the first footage from the documentary for Chasing Earhart? Well, the answer is August 31st, 2017, which is just a couple of weeks away from now. Our editing team is hard at work working on that trailer, making sure it's the very best that it can be before we release it. We will be world premiering that trailer in two locations, on our brand new YouTube page, which we'll get to in just a few moments, and of course on ChasingEarhart.com. Now, if you are a subscriber to ChasingEarhart.com, you will get to see the trailer a day early, so I would encourage you to head over to the website now and enter your name and your email address to be added to the subscriber list. It's free, doesn't cost anything, and we want to appreciate our subscribers and show them how much we appreciate them by giving them content before anyone else. So please head over to ChasingEarhart.com, add yourself to the subscription list, and you'll be the first to see the trailer. Now, the second thing I want to talk about is Phase 2. So for those who don't know, our project takes place in four phases. So the release for the project is fall of 2019. Phase 2 is our longest phase, and we're kicking that off after the release of the trailer on September 1st. We will be moving the project out to Atchison, Kansas for the duration of Phase 2. We have a lot of states to hit, a lot of folks to shoot the documentary with. We'll be traveling through Washington, Montana, Wyoming, New York, Idaho, Iowa, Rhode Island, Florida, and several other states. I believe we're going to Hawaii as well in Phase 2. So we have a lot of different states and a lot of different places we have to hit, and a lot of folks we have to add to the list and shoot for the documentary. So Phase 2 kicks off on September 1st. Be sure to, again, check out our website, look up our social media. We'll have all of our announcements and everything on Phase 2 as it unfolds and all the wonderful things that we have going on. Now, for those out there who follow our website, ChasingEarhart.com, and for those who follow us on social media, on Twitter or on Facebook, you might have seen a post that our social media team put out a couple of days ago regarding a very, very special guest that we're going to have on the podcast in September. This guest is a legend in the Earhart lore and in the Earhart community, and we're very honored to have him. And you might ask how we're able to have him. All will be revealed on September 14th, 2017, as we are honored to welcome legendary radio man and author of Amelia Earhart's Radio, Paul Rafford, to the Chasing Earhart podcast. please listen to that podcast. It's going to be very, very special, and it's going to be something I guarantee you that a lot of people will be talking about in the coming weeks after that podcast airs. Now, the last little tidbit I want to cover is the announcement of our official YouTube channel. So our team is putting together a YouTube channel that's going to have a lot of wonderful content on there for you. We're going to be covering a lot of our podcasts in audio and video form in the near future, which is going to be really great. So you're going to actually get to see the guests as we talk to them live on the show. On top of that, we're going to have over 100 spotlight videos. And most people ask me when I say that, what is a spotlight video? Well, the idea here is we're going to have 5 to 7 minute clips of some of the footage that we've shot from every guest in the Chasing Earhart project. So we're going to have well over 100 of them. And you'll get to know each guest, where they come from, who they are, how they're relevant to Miss Earhart and Mr. Noonan, and how they fit into Chasing Earhart. So by the time the documentary drops in the fall of 2019 and these guests pop up on the documentary, you'll know exactly who it is they are and where they come from. We'll also have classroom sessions on there with Gary LaPook and Pellegrino and a lot more than that. So we're very excited to launch that. We're going to give our subscribers a sneak peek at that YouTube channel once it's done. So it'll be a private channel for them for about a day or two. And then after that, we're going to launch it wide. So again, chasingearhart.com. Go ahead and add your name to that subscriber list. We're going to be doing a lot of fun things in the near future. All right, so now that all that's out of the way, let's get on to this week's guest. So a while back, I was searching online for books on Amelia Earhart. I came across a book called Miss E by Brian Herberger. The foreword caught me immediately. It was a foreword I read to you a little earlier on in the podcast. It's a foreword that makes you want to read more and learn more about the story and these characters. Brian is a first-time author. He's actually writing the follow-up right now to Miss E. I read the book. I ordered it, and I read it, and I read it a second time, and I read it a third time. After I read it the first time, I immediately emailed Brian and said, this is who I am, this is what we're doing, we'd love to have you on the podcast, we'd love to have you as a guest of the project. I think he has a very unique and fresh approach and perspective on Amelia Earhart, and I think it's something a lot of our young followers and young listeners will actually really appreciate. So if you're looking for a good book to get into Amelia Earhart, a book that blends fact and fiction, historical fact and fiction, I think Miss E would be a great opportunity for you to read up on Amelia Earhart and the legacy and the character. So Brian was kind enough with his time to give us a very lengthy interview about the writing process, about the research process, about his thoughts on the impact and legacy of Miss E and how she relates to younger kids and young adults. And it made for a very fascinating interview. So I want to get into it now. Without further ado, I give you all Brian Herberger. So our guest today is Brian Herberger. He's an educator and an author. He wrote a very compelling book about a year ago titled Miss E. And it's a very fascinating book. I've read it myself three times now. I've watched a lot of your videos and preparing for this podcast. I want to welcome you first to the Chasing Earhart podcast. Thank you very much for coming aboard.
Sure. I'm excited to be part of it.
Thank you so much. So I'm going to start this interview the same way I start every interview I do. Just kind of introducing our guest. Can you tell us a little bit about your education and your professional background?
Sure. I've been in education about 25 years. I started out as a middle school English teacher, and I did that for about 12 years, and eventually got into a position that where I was supporting technology in schools, but still, you know, very much involved in teachers and students. And I still work for a school system. But definitely, you know, my motivation as an author has come from just being an English teacher and working with students and reading books with students and reading student writing. So that's, you know, that's when I sat down to write a book, it made sense to write a book geared toward young adults.
Yeah, it's interesting. Writers write for all sorts of different reasons, whether they want to educate or just create something special or just inform people. Why did you decide to become a writer in general? And what made you want to take that route of mixing history with fiction? That's a very fascinating route to take.
I think it's interesting. For some reason, a lot of the books that we end up doing in middle school classrooms are historical fiction. I'm not sure why that is exactly. You know, maybe it makes for great collaboration between the English teacher and the history teacher. So I think as a teacher, those were the books that I was exposed to the most and realized I enjoyed the most. And I think there's varying degrees of historical fiction. And I think some of the historical fiction that you read is very heavy on the history, and you feel like when you're reading it, that there's less story there and it's more like a history lesson. And I feel like my motivation was kind of on the other side of that I really wanted to tell a story. It happens to be a story that's set in a particular era in history, but really, I guess my main goal was just to entertain, to tell a story and create characters. And the era and time was secondary to the characters and what was happening to them, I think.
Gotcha. I must say that I read the book a few times. You've done a great job of mixing several different aspects together to create this single narrative. What made you decide to set the story in the time period that you picked? I know you touched on it a little bit, the Vietnam War in the late 60s. And what made you decide to bring this particular historical character into that mix?
So I started out with the idea of having a young character discover Amelia Earhart. That was the initial idea. And I played around with that idea for a while, trying to figure out, well, where, how would this young person meet her and where would she meet her and what would happen? And I knew that I wanted the Amelia Earhart character to be a certain age. I wanted her to be older. I wanted it to be about 30 years after her flight. So that put the setting in the 60s. And from there, I started to think about, well, what's happening in the 60s that this young person could be involved in. And, her father being in the Vietnam War and the character getting tangled up in some protests were kind of a natural progression of that idea. But mostly it was just, wanting that Amelia Earhart character to be a certain age in the story.
And so since the cat's out of the bag now, we kind of know who Miss E is. I promise there'll be a disclaimer for that earlier on in the podcast.
Sure, yeah.
Can you tell us your earliest recollection of Amelia Earhart just growing up in school and everything, and kind of what your first impressions were of her?
I guess I remember really just knowing one thing about her, that she was this pilot that didn't quite fly all the way around the world. And really that was about as far as my knowledge went. I found her to be a fascinating story, I guess, even knowing very little bit about her. I was fascinated by that there was this mystery behind her disappearance and people didn't really know. Beyond that, I didn't really know even really a whole lot about her flight. What was she flying, and was she with other people or was she by herself? Just as a young person, I had pretty limited knowledge, even though I was interested in that story. And I imagine, what I did know came from, reading about her in a history book or checking out a book at the library or something like that and finding out a little bit about her. So it wasn't really until later that I really kind of dug into her story and learned, so much more about her.
So Forestville, is the town, it's not a fictional town. It's a real town. It's a town where the novel is actually set in. It's just as much a character as anything else in the book. I think the way you describe it and the way you talk about it, especially in the first couple of chapters, can you tell us why you ultimately chose Northern California and then Forestville in particular to be the setting and the backdrop for Missy?
So, I had fun writing about Forestville. I've never been there. I think it'd be fun to visit it sometime, but, I guess my first motivation came from the Amelia Earhart part of the story, that I wanted her to have almost completed that flight and she left from Oakland, and so I wanted her final stopping place to be very close to where she started from. So that, you know, made the location somewhere around San Francisco. And then I also wanted it to be a small town, someplace where she could kind of hide out and come into town, but at the same time sort of be lost, that there wasn't enough people there to really figure out who she really was. And then I also needed a place because of Betsa's part of the story and her father being in the military and going off to Vietnam. I needed a place where that worked as well. And Oakland Army Base during Vietnam was a place where a lot of soldiers left from. So that part of the story fit in that area as well. And then I had fun, finding out a little bit about Forestville and, Google Maps, just kind of searching around and finding a small town that was not too far away from San Francisco. And I think, I'm from a small town myself and I think a lot of what I put into Forestville probably comes from my own personal experience. Even though I've never been there or been to a small town in California, I think I just sort of transferred that from what I know.
And it's interesting. You touched on personal experience. I was watching a YouTube video where you're presenting to a class and you touched on personal experience and how writers kind of tend to draw from a personal experience. And sometimes we create characters based off of that. We know who Miss E is created after, obviously, but is there anybody in particular that you model Betts after?
People ask that a lot. I have a teenage daughter, so I think people assume that I've put a lot of my daughter into this character. Reality is I started writing this about 4 years ago. My daughter was that much younger. So she's not necessarily modeled after a single person. I think probably just my experience in middle school and years of middle school age kids have given me a lot to draw on. And I think probably like a lot of good characters, she's just kind of a mix of a lot of people where you sort of pick and choose character traits. And I wanted her to be sort of this spunky tomboyish sort of character. And there are certainly a lot of people in my life that I could model her after and pull character traits from. So she's a mix of a lot of people.
Like a melting pot.
Yep, exactly.
So let's talk a little bit about the town of Forestville and their residents and what they know about Missy. And I'll synopsize a little bit from the book here. No one really knows her name. She's essentially a recluse. So she's living alone on the outskirts of town in this old farmhouse. There's only a few people still alive that may remember her name. But memories have become mixed up with stories, and it's kind of difficult to tell what's real and what's not. That last part I find interesting because it ties very much so into the real life story of Amelia Earhart. The story of Miss Earhart has become so tied into theory and many different hypotheses that are out there that it really has become difficult to kind of ascertain and determine what's real and what's not. Did you draw on that during your research for writing the character of Missy? Did you kind of take all that into consideration?
I definitely, part of my research involved running into these various theories. I think that was kind of inevitable because there's a lot out there. I think one of the things that really fascinates me about Amelia Earhart is that mystery around her disappearance. And so I wanted the same sort of mystery around that character of Miss E, even though the people in town don't know who she is. I wanted her to be a mysterious character, someone that they saw occasionally and sort of, gossiped a little about and had these theories about, very much in the same way that people have treated Earhart's disappearance. So I think there's definitely a connection there between the way the theories have gotten passed around and kind of the way that they gossip about this Miss E character.
Yeah, it's interesting. One of the hypotheses, one of the many hypotheses regarding what became of Miss Earhart is widely known as the Irene Bolam hypothesis. You might have come across that name in your research. Essentially, the idea here is that Irene Bolam, or Miss Earhart rather, survived her flight. And she was a captive of the Japanese, and she was over in Saipan for about 7 to 8 years, either in a prison or in a palace, depending on who you go with and who you listen to. Her return is then, you know, negotiated roughly 8 or 9 years later. And after that, she's smuggled back into the U.S. secretly, and she lives in New Jersey. And she's, you know, obviously a recluse, much like the character of Miss E, obviously on the opposite coast. Had you heard about that hypothesis when you were doing research? Did that one kind of come across your desk when you were looking into stuff?
I did. I didn't know about it when I initially got the idea for the book. And like I said, I discovered once I started researching that I really knew very little about Amelia Earhart, and really just enjoyed learning a lot about her. But I didn't know about this theory, and when I came across it, I was really kind of surprised that there was a, you know, a theory like that, and that had happened. And I didn't, I guess one thing I had already decided with my book was that, you know, her identity wasn't going to come out. That we had this one character that discovers her, but it's, you know, it wasn't going to be part of the story that, you know, that word gets around and people are sort of, you know, surprised at her appearance or that sort of thing. So, I felt like when I did discover that theory that it was far enough away from what I was creating that it wasn't like a, you know, it didn't create a conflict for me, I guess.
Yeah. I could tell by reading the book a few times now that a lot of work was put into, imagining and creating what would be a much older version or 30 years older version of Amelia Earhart. What was that process like for you from a creative standpoint in creating this version of this character that, you know, might exist 30 years after her subsequent disappearance?
Yeah. That was really important for me. And when I got the initial idea for the story and then kind of mulled that over for a while and decided what the Betz's story was going to be and where this was going to fit in time. I realized pretty quickly that I needed to know enough about Amelia Earhart to create her as a character. You know, I wasn't creating a character out of nothing. And I felt the importance of that this character of Miss E fit with the person that Amelia Earhart was. So I spent probably about 5 or 6 months just reading, and getting to know her as a person. And it helped that she's written several books about her life because I felt like I, you know, her voice is in those books and her personality is in those books. So, those were really useful in getting to know her as a person. You know, and then there's a certain amount of imagination to sort of decide, well, what would she be like 30 years later, and what would she be like, you know, after kind of hiding herself away for so long? So, you know, I definitely superimposed some things on top of her real life character.
So let's shift a little bit to the relationship between Betz and Miss E, which is in many ways, obviously the backbone of the book. Can you speculate as to what it is about Betz that compels Miss E, this reclusive woman, to sort of come out of her shell and become a mentor figure for her in this story?
That's a good question. And it's one that in the book, Betz sort of wonders herself because she's heard enough about Miss E to know that, you know, no one knows much about her and she doesn't really have any contact with anyone. She doesn't talk to anyone. And then all of a sudden she is with Betz and she, you know, has her delivering groceries to her house and keeps running into her in town. And so at one point, Betts just asks her, well, why me? You know, you stay away from everyone else. Why me? And Missy kind of laughs at that question and says, well, it's because you remind me of myself when I was your age. So I think that's part of it. I think that I wanted Miss E to connect with this younger person because she sees herself in Betts. But at the same time, I think that the character of Miss E, is realizing this is someone that I can open up to, that I, you know, she's hidden herself away and hidden her story away for so long. And I think she sees someone in Betts that she could potentially share her story with and kind of let that out to her.
Yeah, I think I was going to ask a specific question, but I think I'll kind of shift it a little bit. But in talking about Betts, we have this 15-year-old girl who is different a little bit, and she is kind of a tomboy in certain ways. And you know, she's dealing with this aspect of her father leaving, who is someone who she's very close to, and she has a great deal of love and admiration for. And at the same time, she's dealing with a relationship with her mother that's not necessarily like a lot of relationships that daughters have with their mothers at that age. And then, of course, being an outsider to a new town, so. I think maybe it might be safe to assume that Miss E kind of sees, as you touched on, herself in that aspect. You know, she kind of became an outsider. At one point, Miss E was an outsider in this new town, and she just kind of had this sense of isolation. And I think maybe Betts might have felt the same kind of sense of isolation, and they kind of connected and bonded over that.
Sure. Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. So I want to talk about an event that happens early on in the book. The first time Betts actually steps foot in the house, there was a mishap earlier on than that, but let's say the first time she steps foot into Missy's home, just before the event occurs, she notices a photo in Mr. Flynn's class of this mysterious woman that she doesn't recognize. And, it's a photo that she can't seem to stop thinking about. When she is walking down this hallway of Missy's house, she sees all these mysterious photos of this character that's with all these famous people, Eleanor Roosevelt, and just so many different people that Amelia Earhart obviously was very close to in her life. I'm going to ask you to speculate here a little bit. What is going through Betts' mind when she's walking down this hallway and she's looking at all these photos of this same woman that's with all these different people? She hasn't put two and two together yet. She's getting there, but she hasn't done it quite yet.
Yeah. That was it. That was an interesting balance. Thinking about the story and realizing that I needed to do two things. I needed to kind of pull Betts along into this mystery and at the same time, keep the reader part of that mystery. And so there are things along the way, like those photographs that give a little hint and they, you know, like you say, Betts starts to put two and two together. And at the same time, the reader is starting to put these clues together. And initially she even sees those photos and she doesn't recognize that as the same person at first. And it's not until a little bit later that she realizes, oh, this person in the photos on the wall is the same one in my classroom. But I definitely, you know, that was something I felt like I needed to be careful with, where I didn't want to spoil it right away. But at the same time, I didn't want the reader to figure it out and sit there thinking, this girl's dumb. Like, why doesn't she get it? So I, you know, I tried to kind of sprinkle these little clues here and there, and the photos on the wall were definitely one of them.
Yeah, the tomato juice, nice touch. Really nice touch, by the way. And also, I want to give you some kudos and a huge amount of credit for the name nickname Millie, because my wife actually, early on in this project, she said, oh, did you know her nickname was Millie? And I had no idea. I've been doing 4 years of research. Wow. And for some reason, didn't come across that. And she saw that you pointed out Millie was her, you know, nickname, and she was just so vindicated that she's like, see, look, he's writing about it. It's pretty cool.
When I was researching, I just, you know, I took notes and highlighted on really just a wide variety of things. I wasn't sure what I would need about her real person to fit in with her, with the character. So I really just kind of grabbed every piece of information that I thought might be useful. And that was one that I came along. And then in creating Bette's character, Bette's kind of has this thing about her name where, you know, her name's Elizabeth, but she doesn't really like that. It's too formal. And her teachers and her mother call her that. She doesn't like it. And her dad calls her Bette's. And that's the nickname that she feels fits with who she is. So when she meets Miss E and Miss E is asking her, well, what is your name or what do you call yourself? I realized, I can kind of flip that back at her and have Bette's ask Miss E, well, what do you call yourself? Because, you know, Miss E, well, you know, everyone calls her that, but that's not her name. So I was able to dig into my notes and take advantage of this cool nickname.
Yeah, nicely done. It's those little things that kind of really kind of flesh out characters, a lot like they do in scripts and films. You know, little things, these little twitches and these little things that people might not necessarily know that just makes a character, you know, so much more fleshed out.
Sure. Yeah.
So I want to read a particularly powerful passage from the book. And it's, I want to read it verbatim here. There was no way I was telling this secret. Room 110 would have to wait to find out who the mystery woman on the wall was. I was holding three books in my hands that described how her life ended out near some tiny island in the Pacific Ocean. But I knew that come Wednesday of next week, I'd be delivering a box of groceries to Amelia Earhart. As Bette starts to put things together, she remembers, of course, the similarities that we kind of touched on a little bit, the sly smile that she's seeing in all the Amelia Earhart books and the ones that match on Missy's walls. Then comes the tomato juice that we touched on a little bit that she notices Amelia loves and that Missy was sipping on during their first meeting. Things start to unravel for her, and I love the analogy of being close to putting that puzzle together. And then finally, it hits her. What must that be like for a 15-year-old girl of all people in this world to maybe stumble into the discovery of the greatest cold case of the last couple of centuries?
Yeah. So I really like her initial reaction, which is she's not going to tell anyone, which I think is very much a 15-year-old reaction. She's got this really amazing piece of information. And she knows how good it is. She knows how important it is. But she loves the idea of having this secret and holding on to this secret. So I like that that's her initial reaction. And then what comes after, you know, after she sort of confronts her and gets her story and confirms that, yes, this is Amelia Earhart. The next chapter kind of starts out with her reaction to that. And she's expecting something to be different. You know, she realizes the importance of discovering this person and Amelia Earhart's importance in history. But then she realizes the next day, well, I'm going to school and it's the same routine. And not everything has changed just because I met this important person. And she has the same reaction a little bit later in the book. Amelia Earhart takes her for a flight in this old biplane. And she again sort of discovers the next day that, you know, even though Amelia wanted to, you know, change her perspective on things and get her to see her mother in a different light, and she's taken her on this amazing trip in this old airplane, the next day she still kind of feels like, well, nothing's changed. And I think what that gets at is that the significance, the real important change is going to come from Bette herself. That even though she's encountering this amazing person, the changes in Bette's character don't come from her just making this discovery. They come from herself and the things that she learns about herself.
And, you know, it's interesting, just touching back on that time period again, but in 67, just as, you know, kind of as a annotation to what we're talking about, that was really kind of the time where everything exploded in the Amelia Earhart disappearance and all the different hypotheses started kind of coming out of nowhere. You had, you know, the people that believe that she was on Saipan, and, you know, and those people that believe that she was, you know, that this was just a few years before the Amelia Earhart Lives book comes out and all these different things. So I think that even you weaving that time period in with all these different things, all these highly powerful, successful men and these companies and the government's looking for her. And then this 15-year-old girl just stumbles up, the most unlikeliest person stumbled upon on her in a place that nobody would ever think to look. And right. I think it's very nicely done. It's neat how you kind of woven that in.
Yeah. Well, it was fun. It was fun to create that story.
So the confessional is really beautifully written. So good that as you read it, you begin to believe that Amelia Earhart is actually confessing to you. She's talking to you, the reader. What do you think it is about Betts? And then really that moment in particular, I know we kind of touched on Betts and her impact with Miss Earhart, but that moment in particular that just made Miss E want to just kind of spill the beans after all these years and say, yes, you know, this is who I am. I am this person. What was it about that moment that kind of had that impact?
Well, I think like I mentioned before, you know, Miss E kind of seeing a little bit of herself in Betts and wanting to reach out to her, I think was part of it, that she felt like, well, this is someone that I can finally tell this to. You know, I've been holding on to this for 30 years and I can finally, you know, share it with someone. And I think the other part of that was just finally having someone discover her, where she felt like she had this secret, she had this story that she had to keep to herself and she had to hide herself away. But finally being found out, even if it is just by a 15-year-old girl that, you know, stumbled across her, you know, in library books, eventually being found out, I think that sort of gives her license to come clean and share that story. That, you know, it's a story that there's a lot of regret in there. So I think it's something that has really kind of been building up over the years and gnawing at her. And so, you know, finally having someone to open up and share it with is something I think that she's been wanting to do and just hasn't had someone there.
Yeah. It's interesting that you touched on that because it kind of reads like a confessional, and it reads as you're reading it, you're listening to this woman talk and you're feeling all these different emotions and these different things that just kind of come out. And it feels like as a reader, you're feeling like you're feeling this character's lifting this huge weight off her chest. And she's finally able to say, you know, yeah, this is what happened. And this is really the truth of my life and kind of what became of me after the flight. So it's a special moment. It really is. Can you discuss, and we'll kind of segue a little bit, but can you discuss the character of Sam Casey and how did you come up with him and tie him into Amelia's backstory?
Yeah. Okay. So Amelia's backstory was probably the trickiest part of the book. Because it's the part where the historical Amelia Earhart and the character that I built around the real person, really sort of takes a turn into what is truly fiction, that made up part of, you know, what happened after her flight and I really kind of struggled with her motivation for doing what she did, for not completing the flight and hiding herself away. And I knew I needed a good reason for that and a reason that was believable to the reader and also something that fit with the true, you know, the real Amelia Earhart. So that made up character of Sam Casey is actually kind of very, you know, loosely motivated by the real Samuel Chapman, who Amelia Earhart was engaged to. And I toyed with the idea of, well, would she, you know, could she fall in love and could she find someone, maybe someone on her flight that makes her decide, well, I'm going to leave my old life to be with this new person. And that didn't really, that didn't convince me, that she would do that. So I really kind of came down to, you know, her, really just being tired of the spotlight, and, you know, loving to fly, but at the same time, not loving the, you know, the crowds that went along with that and the media that went along with her leaving or returning. And so I left this very minor character as part of the story that, well, she could have someone that she's going to. And then I needed there to be a little bit of tragedy in that she made this decision. She had this person that she wanted to be with. And then, you know, something happened to him that she ends up on her own again and not really, in a place that she wanted to be truly. So, you know, he's a totally made up character, but at the same time, he comes a little bit from her real story and, mostly just, you know, needing a reason for her to do what she did to end her flight and hide herself away.
Yeah, it's touching on the tragedy of that all of having someone to go to, I think, and then just, you know, thinking, yeah, I made the right choice and this is right, this feels right. And then all of a sudden, you know, well, what would you do if that person was no longer there anymore? And now you're on your own and you're truly, you know, you can't go back to that life that you had before. You know, for all intents and purposes, you're dead, you know, to the world. They buried you essentially. And you know, now you're kind of stuck between a rock and a hard place, so to speak, because you're alone. Right. So it's very tragic and you can feel that tragedy come across, in what she's saying. So,
well, and it also gave me an opportunity to create a parallel, you know, Amelia losing this person she cared about in a war and then Beth's having her father away. So I ended up with an interesting parallel of both of them, you know, having someone that they cared about that's involved in a war. So.
Yeah, you know, that's a great point. I didn't connect that yet. Even after three times, I didn't connect that parallel yet. But as Betts is listening to Miss E tell this very detailed backstory of how she came to be on the farm, I'm reading along, and before I can get to Betts's initial reaction or her first words, I keep asking myself if I'm her, and you know, and I'm doing, you know, the project I'm doing and everything I'm working on. What's the first thing I would ask if I were her in position and if I were in her position? And the first thing I'd ask is, well, where's the plane? And then I get to the line where she says, where's the plane? I literally was like, oh my gosh, it's cool. Cause it's kind of it's like an aha moment for me too. It's a really neat moment.
Yeah, sure.
Curiosity is great there.
Yeah. Right. No, I mean, I think that would have been my first question as well, that, you know, you get this whole backstory and why she did what she did and how she ended up where she is. But, you know, there's still the logistics of, well, you've got this aircraft that, you know, has to go somewhere. So yeah, that was, it was a fun way to end that chapter, because for most of the chapter, it's just Miss E talking and telling her whole story. And then at the very end, you kind of get a, you know, this thought that Betts has that's, I think, like you say, kind of the obvious question, where's the plane?
Yeah, it's interesting because I'm reading it. I believe, where's the plane? Well, at least on the version, because I had it on my iPhone. And so I was watching or reading it on my iPhone for the times I had it. And where's the plane ends the chapter.
Yes.
And then you turn the page, it's like the Electra. I was like, oh, we're going to find out. It's not going to be teased. It's going to find out right now where the plane is. And it's interesting because, you know, her plane is one of the most iconic, you know, aircrafts of all time. It's especially now with the disappearance and you have people, you know, looking for it now. And the way that it's described again is masterfully done. I love how you do it. And it just, the way you explain it, it just, you really feel like this is the condition the plane would be in. This is kind of, yeah, it makes sense that you would start this thing up every month and, you know, she would kind of keep it maintained a little bit. You can imagine standing there and seeing this thing, and it's being hunted right now as we speak, as you and I talk right now. There's There was a crew, actually they just got back from the crew called by the name of Nauticos. They just got back with Elgin Long mapping this part of the ocean where they believe that the plane might be. There's people that are searching for this thing all over the planet, essentially. How did you go about bringing the Lockheed Electra back into kind of reintroducing it, into the story and into the world? Because it really is a character in its own. I mean, when you think Amelia Earhart, you think she goes one and one with that plane.
Sure. Yeah. That was a chapter that I had in my head long before I wrote it. There were a couple chapters that I knew this was going to happen. And so it was a scene that I just replayed time and time again. So when I sat down to write it, it was really, really pretty clear in my mind. And number one, I just wanted the sense that, you know, this plane was put into this barn 30 years ago, and it's exactly how it was when it was put in there. So when Missy opens that door and Beth sees it, I really wanted the sense of really just kind of the weight of time. She describes the kind of the dust hanging in the air, getting caught in the sunlight, and almost like it was put in there and just kind of everything was frozen. And then I also liked the idea that, this plane had been around the world. This plane had been so many different places. And it was showing the signs of wear and the signs of time. I'm fortunate enough to live in the DC area and the air and space, the Smithsonian Air and Space is one of my favorite places. So to go there and see Earhart's Vega is a treat. And it's a beautiful plane. And then the contrast of that is the Smithsonian now has, one of the space shuttles, and they made a point of when they brought that to the Smithsonian, really not restoring it. It looks like it's been to space and back. And I love that they did that, because you can go and see it and tell that this was a workhorse. And it's seen a lot of use. So I wanted that same sense that, you know, this was a plane that had been around the world and was showing signs of that. And then also the way that Miss E treats it, we put a lot of significance on this plane, because of who flew it and because of what happened with it. But to Miss E, it's just her plane. So she at one point just kind of turns to Betts and says, well, you can touch it. It's not in a museum. So I think there's that kind of that interesting contrast that there is a lot of weight to this plane and importance to this plane. But at the same time, this character of Miss E, well, it's her plane that she, you know, has climbed in and out of thousands of times. So, but that was definitely a great, great chapter to write.
Yeah, it had that. When I'm reading it, it had that Force Awakens vibe with the Millennium Falcon, you know, being covered in this famous, you know, aircraft, and it's just been sitting there, right, hunk of junk or whatever, you know, for 30, 40, who knows how long in that movie, but for 30 years, and it's just, there's so much value put on this plane that everybody calls that plane the smoking gun. If you look, yeah, at all the different theories and the hypotheses that are out there, well, the smoking gun would be finding the plane. You know, if we could find, sure, the plane or pull, right, the plane out of the ocean, that would be it. And, it's just interesting that how you wrote it, how it was kind of, introduced. It's just really nice.
It's interesting that you mentioned the search for the plane. And that was something I followed while I was writing. And I spent a year kind of crossing my fingers that they wouldn't find anything, because I felt like, a lot of the fun in my book is the mystery of what happened to Amelia Earhart. And I felt like, well, if that mystery is taken away, then it, it, uh, you know, takes part of the story away. So I felt a little pressure to finish writing and get the book published before they can find it now. That's fine. Now that the book is out there.
So sitting in this Electra with Amelia Earhart, for me, it would be surreal. I mean, there's no really words to describe that feeling and how that must be. I mean, for a 15-year-old girl, it might feel a little bit different, but when Missy is describing her trip and coming so close, you know, she talks about those last 50 miles. She was there essentially. She never comes across as more vulnerable and more imprisoned between, you know, her own dream and her subsequent current reality. What was the thought process in putting together a scene like this? And it kind of works as another confessional, so to speak, but you really see that vulnerability in Missy. What is that process like for you in creating that scene?
Yeah, that was, I really, writing this chapter, I think there was a lot of thought that went into this chapter, and it was something that I replayed many times before I sat down to write. One thing that was really important for me was that I wanted Miss E to have a good reason for not only doing what she did initially and ending her flight and hiding herself away, but a good reason for staying hidden away. And so I wanted that scene to really show, to really kind of give the reader that feeling of being stuck. And I think there's a nice parallel between the plane being stuck in the barn, you know, this thing that should be flying through the air, and it's undercover and it's behind a door. The parallel between that and how that character of Miss E feels, that she, you know, she should be out, you know, in the world and with other people, and she's stuck on this farm. So I really wanted to give Betts that sense, and also the reader that sense that, you know, she's stuck here. She's staying here. It's not by choice. And there's really, really some weight to that she's, you know, she's stuck and kind of dealing with the consequences of a decision that went awry.
So we've talked about the characters and the setup to the point where Betts meets Miss E and finds out who she really is. That's a major point in the book. I think that this is probably the right place to stop the discussion. I think we've certainly whet the appetite for potential readers and people who might not have read the book yet. But what I want to do is I want to ask you to reflect a little bit on the whole process, because I know writing a book is, you know, I couldn't do it personally. It's a daunting task, and it's years of sometimes years and years of research. And as you touched on throughout this interview, kind of getting certain things right, mixing history with fiction. But even though you're writing a lot of fiction here, you're having to kind of incorporate the historical aspects of things. Can you kind of touch a little bit on your whole experience in general writing this book from, you know, pre-research all the way to finish? And are you happy with the way the book came out? Is there anything on reflection that you think, oh, I should have added this, or I maybe took away this, or whatever the case is?
Yeah. I definitely enjoyed the whole process. I'd never written a complete novel. I've, you know, started things and put them away. And I think at first I was really just writing for fun. I had an idea that I was excited about and I wanted to explore that idea. And it wasn't really until about halfway through writing that I felt like, well, yeah, this is, you know, this is going somewhere. This is something that's going to, you know, I'm going to finish this and take it through to being published. And I definitely, you know, I enjoyed the whole process. I enjoyed creating the story. I enjoyed the research and learning about Amelia Earhart. I enjoyed the, you know, the publishing process and certainly having people read my book and hear from readers is very exciting. As far as something I would change or add to it, you know, there's, I discovered in the editing process that you could pretty much edit. It seems like you could edit a book forever. And you know, the number of times that I went through and just tweaking one or two words here and there, at some point you just have to decide, well, this is it. You know, and I had gotten some feedback from people early on that I had shared it with it and incorporated that feedback. But, at some point, you know, you have to decide, well, this is the book. And there are certainly things, you know, even now as I'm, you know, I'll visit schools and read some sections out loud. And, I wish I could go back and tweak words here and there still. And then of course there's, you know, as much research as you do, there are always things that, you know, there's always someone that knows more. I had actually someone from the Smithsonian that read it that, you know, mentioned that the aircraft stored in the barn, the tires would be gone. You know, the tires would have rotted away years ago. And you know, that's a detail that, you know, someone who is an expert in historic aircraft and what you need to do to preserve them, would know right away. But you know, the average person reading it is not going to know it. So there are things like that, that, you know, at some point you have to, I guess, what do I want to say? There are things like that, that, you know, you, at some point you decide the book is as good as you can make it, and you're ready to share it with readers.
Yeah. I mean, there's a sense of creativeness there. I mean, I get what you're talking about certain people and, you know, doing what we do and the historians and the people that are experts, sometimes they have to understand, you know, in this case, you're writing a little bit, if you're mixing some fiction in there, it's the same thing with doing a film or writing a screenplay. It's not, you want to get those facts in there. Of course you want to get things in there, but you got to have a little bit of creative license, I think, to, you know, spark that reader's imagination. Well, man, they could fly right out of that barn if they wanted to, you know, it's, you know, maybe technically not, but you know, it's part of the fiction, part of the fiction of the story. And I think it plays very well.
Sure. Yeah.
So can you tell us, do you have another project on tap? Is there another book that you're writing, or what's your next steps with something future and as far as books are concerned?
Yeah. Well, I really enjoyed this, writing this book, and, you know, decided even before it was done that, you know, this was something I wanted to keep doing. And I started researching for another book idea that very similar to this, and that there's a young character that meets someone in American history that has a little mystery as, you know, around his life and his death, and sort of discovers this person years later. Cause I really enjoyed that with Amelia Earhart, kind of playing on this historical fiction, but also sort of throwing in a twist. I started researching that and then decided I wasn't quite ready to leave the characters I'd already created. So I'm writing, or have written, and I'm now editing the sequel to Miss E. Sadly, the character of Miss E does not return. But Betts, returns, and some other characters that were in Miss E come back. Cause I realized that, you know, this young character of Betts is, there's really still a lot of story, left in her life. So it's something that takes place a year later, still kind of focusing on the Vietnam War and the effects of the war at home. But definitely really just enjoyed kind of getting back into her character and writing more of her story.
So where can folks find you online and follow your work and just kind of be kept abreast of all the current updates on what you're doing?
Well, the best place to start is my website, which is brianherberger.com. From there you can, you know, you can find me as on Facebook and Twitter, and find my books online as well. So, but that's the best place to start.
Brian, it's been an absolute honor. Thank you so much for coming aboard the Chasing Earhart podcast. It's been a pleasure, and I love the book. I'm reading it again for a fourth time to my 7-year-old son now. It really, you've made a big fan of me and my work. And I remember when I reached out to you initially, I said, I got to talk to this guy, because it's just a fascinating, you know, way that you've kind of approached the subject, and you've approached Miss Earhart, and just, you know, you've done a great job of this. So it's been a pleasure. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you. It's been a lot of fun. I'm glad to be involved in the podcast.
I really hope you enjoyed that interview with Brian Herberger. It was a very fascinating interview for me. I really enjoyed his take and his fresh perspective on Amelia Earhart. For those who want to enjoy that take fully and read the whole book, and for those who push through the spoiler warning at the beginning of the show, I would advise you to go out and pick up a copy of Miss E as soon as you can. You can order it at Amazon.com, Miss E, or you can just go right to Brian's website at brianherberger.com. Miss E's right on the front, and you can purchase it right through his website. Go out and support him. He's very great, and we're going to have him back on the podcast when we do our roundtable podcast in October. So before we leave you this week, I want to talk about the next episode of Chasing Earhart. We always like to give a preview of what we have coming up for the very next episode of the podcast, and this one's a doozy. So we are honored to bring aboard this guest. It's someone who we've actually been trying to get for a long time, and she was gracious enough to give us some of her time. She's a very busy girl, but we're honored to have her, and that is none other than Abigail Harrison, otherwise known as Astronaut Abby online. I would encourage you ahead of this podcast to go and check her out at astronautabby.com. Also, search themarsgeneration.org online. She is the founder of the Mars Generation. She is currently at an internship at the Kennedy Center in Florida. I think that's going to be wrapping up pretty soon. But she will be traveling and doing a lot of speaking. She's very, very well known worldwide, especially in the aerospace community and within NASA and with a lot of folks out there that are just fans of aerospace and space travel. And Abby has a very, very specific goal, and I don't want to spoil it, but we'll talk about that goal among many other things. We're going to talk about her goals, her dreams, what drives her, getting over your fears and facing your fears to achieve your dreams. We're going to talk about the future of STEM and everything she's doing to push that future forward. And we're also going to talk about Amelia Earhart, her impact on her personally, and the impact that she continues to have on modern women in aerospace and aviation to this day. So it's going to make for a really great episode, and we're very excited to bring that to you next time on Chasing Earhart, Episode 7. But for now, this is Chris Williamson, project creator of Chasing Earhart. We're signing off, and we will see you in 2 weeks.